Coming up today, so much stuff and so many things. Disney has created a system that lets you transfer secret audio messages by touching people with your finger. Plus, we discover that when dung beetles get lost, they can navigate their way home by looking at the Milky Way. And iOS 7 gets released ahead of the new iPhone's launch, and we've got some opinions about that. Plus, we talk to Genevieve Bell from Intel's Research Labs about why you are beginning to love your devices in your pocket a bit like you love humans. All that is just for starters, coming up over the next half hour. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and interesting from science and tech to Disney fingers and Ig Nobel Research Awards. I'm your host, Nate Langson, and I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Olivia underscore Solon.
And I'm Nicholas Stuffnell.
Yes, you are. Nicholas, back for a second stint because apparently you were brilliant last week. Liat is back from her wedding and safari honeymoon, but she sounds like a banshee right now and has gone home ill. So,
if a banshee sounds like a snotty grizzly monster
bag of ill, yeah. But get well soon, Liat. She's just been so high on marriage. We're going to get straight into the news now. iOS 7 is out. It's actually being released as we record the podcast, but it is out by the time everybody hears this. The new iPhones are out on Friday, as we know, so we're not going to recap any of that, but we have had good reports about iOS 7, good and bad, actually. Most people seem to quite like iOS 7, I think, for the most part, even though it lacks a number of critical improvements, perhaps, in some areas. Liv's looking sceptical.
Well, no, I think when it first was announced, which is a while back now, there was quite a lot of criticism of it being very flat and looking very generic like other operating systems. However, we have very recently had a very positive, glowing critique of it on our website.
We have, yes. I'm going to read a little quote out here because I think it's actually quite telling. Apple's new iOS 7 represents the most substantial change to the iPhone since it started supporting third-party apps. But as dramatic as the update may look, it doesn't go far enough functionally. iOS 7 is gorgeous, and this is where Apple's great design lead, Jony Ive, gets to wow us with a palette of bits instead of atoms, and what he's come up with is wonderful. It fronts an entirely modern look and feel, full of bold colours and stylish typefaces. It's more iconic and less cartoonish. Old leatherette flourishes banished in favour of empty space that lets images and data do the talking. Now that's a pretty positive bit of critique from our review on Wired.co.uk, but it does lack iOS 7, that is, not our review, new ways of interacting with data, I think. So Android's got these voice commands like Google Now, so the Moto X is a great example of this. The phone could be sat on a desk and you could just say, Google Now, what's the weather? Or Google Now, read me XYZ, and it will just, it knows your voice and specifically the tone and the fingerprint, audio fingerprint of your voice, and responds to you and only you. So there's nothing like that in iOS 7, at least yet. And and Windows Phone has these really great live tiles. So the apps, sort of as they appear on a home screen, can actually display data and information that is updated as data comes in. So you don't need to load that app. Yeah. And currently, Apple doesn't offer anything really like that, apart from, say, Notification Center and push updates and things. And also Android has widgets and interactive home screen elements and stuff like that. So none of those are coming to iOS 7. And I do think it's a little bit of a shame. I've been using Android for on my work phone as my work phone for a while now, using a Galaxy S4. And I've really come to appreciate widgets and a more sort of customized feel to a home screen that means I can do more without loading apps.
Yeah.
But I think for the most part, people seem pretty pleased with iOS 7, and there's a lot of potential with the new hardware as well that's going to take advantage of some new features like fingerprint sensor and 64-bit processing. So you guys going to update, Liv? You've got an iPad?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I might wait and see how you get along with it first.
That's fair. I am a bit of a guinea pig.
I mean, I rather pathetically stayed up until midnight and was refreshing my settings page and it wasn't there.
Nicholas, rookie mistake. Apple only cares about US local time.
Of course. So they release 6 this evening.
It's within the next hour of as recording.
West Coast US time as well.
Cupertino time.
Yeah. California time.
Well, let us know if you've updated and what your first impressions are. We'll read some out on the show next week, so do get those in as quickly as possible. podcast@wired.co.uk. Now, Liv, you've been writing about what Disney's been doing with its fingers.
Yes, I have, and that sounds much more sinister than it needs to be.
No, I'm not sure.
I just brushed my nose against the microphone. That was extraordinary. But you know that when you use some laptops, you can kind of feel a sort of electrostatic vibration, often when they're kind of plugged into the wall. It's sort of a sort of eerie texture that if you rub your hand across, quite often Macs actually, you can feel that sort of vibration-y texture feeling. Well, that phenomenon is something that Disney is harnessing, so to allow you to poke someone near their ear in order to transmit a secret message that only they can hear.
This is just so many levels of amazing, but it does make me sort of kind of fear being in line at Disneyland and having someone touch me and I hear a voice.
Yeah, well, as with all Disney research, the researchers here had to try and think of an application for the technology before, you know, they develop it. So their idea was, as you say, perhaps finding ways for people to interact with each other in queues at Disney theme parks. But the way it works is, they have this microphone, which you speak into, obviously, and record a little message that then gets looped. Now, this is then converted into an inaudible signal, one that's very high voltage. Well, not very, very high voltage, but high voltage and low current. And this then gets transmitted into your body through the metal of the microphone. You can then go up and poke someone near their ear. So kind of perhaps, I don't know what it's called, the little blobby bit that at the entrance of your ear, and your ear then will act as a sort of speaker, and the vibrations will turn into sound, and so you will be able to hear whatever message they spoke into that microphone.
And who is this aimed at? I mean, am I at risk of going to Disneyland and sort of seeing Mickey Mouse come up with me with his finger out and sort of run for my life?
It's so early. This is their kind of R&D lab. They come up with all sorts of incredible concepts.
But Disney, you don't associate this with Disney.
Yeah.
Nicholas, do you ever associate this with Disney?
No.
This kind of R&D?
No, it's bizarre. And also, didn't they say that there was... It could be used for romantic applications as well. You could have a secret message that you could then deliver to someone that
you like.
Call me old-fashioned, but I don't want anyone sticking their finger in my ear to deliver me some sort of secret love message.
Yeah.
It's my least favourite orifice.
Yeah, I agree.
Anything foreign going in my ear feels weird, and I don't want it there.
Fair enough. I don't think you have to go in your ear. It's more just touching the area near your ear.
And does the finger need to be moist, like a wet willy?
No, it doesn't need to be moist like a wet willy. Okay. But yeah, the technology was actually first came out after they were developing something else called Tesla Touch, which was a haptic screen technology so you could feel textures. And that then kind of translated into this. And I think they were kind of, it was almost a bit of a nice surprise that they could come up with a secondary technology. So I don't know if we're going to be seeing this immediately in the queues at Disney, but watch out for Mickey's finger.
Nicholas, becoming something of our regular weird stuff in space correspondent on the podcast, this week you are going to be talking about detachable snake-like robots that could partner up with Mars rovers. And this extends from last week's conversation about space spiders 3D printing stuff sort of in orbit.
Yeah, exactly. From spiders to snakes. So there's a detachable snake-like robot that could potentially partner up with future Mars rovers thanks to a European Space Agency commissioned feasibility study currently being carried out by SINTEF. So essentially, the snake attachment allows greater access to Martian nooks and crannies. It's sort of like a robot snake, essentially, that can wiggle about and find things that a standard rover otherwise couldn't find.
A robo-snake, you might say.
A robo-snake, yeah.
Yeah.
So one option, they're not quite sure how to implement this at the moment. One option is to make the snake one of the Mars rover's arms, with the ability to detach and reattach and then sort of roam independently once it's detached.
So kind of go-go gadget snake arms.
Yeah,
snakes don't have arms, Liv.
No, but Curiosity would have two arms. It would be snakes, for example, or the next Curiosity. And then it could say, go, detach. Boop, 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 boop.
Oh, I see what you mean.
And they would just like...
Before it already had arms, it would be a different appendage, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
It reminded me of Crichton's detachable groin.
Yes, his groinal attachments.
Yeah,
useful for all sorts of stuff. We've had Crichton on the show before.
Oh, have we?
Yeah.
Well, it can't whisk eggs like his groin attachment can, but it can do a lot of other interesting stuff. It's also possible that the snake robot will be kept on a leash if the arms don't work. This will make communications and power issues easier to handle. So it wouldn't have to carry around its own wireless comms or batteries. And also, which is kind of weird, they hope that if the rover gets into a sticky situation and is trapped somewhere, the snake could potentially coil around a rock near the rover and use that to anchor the rover so that you could then pull pull the little robot out of the cranny.
This has so many levels of awesome. I don't know which one to ask about first. When are we going to see this?
Well, the ESA plans to have its rover on Mars in 2018, and it's supposed to sort of join the rover, but we're not sure if it's going to be there with it because it's still just an idea at the moment.
Liv, do you like the idea of robo moon snakes?
I love the idea. In fact, any animal themed robots, I'm in.
Mars rovers would be good.
I mean,
good.
That would obviously be better, but
yeah, pugs, robo pug.
Nate, you don't need to keep on going with this.
All right, okay.
We know that I like robot animals.
Okay. Netflix purchases shows partly based on illegal download figures. Olivia_Solon is about to explain.
Yeah. Well, this is another example of how brilliant Netflix's data strategy is. One of the company's execs, Kelly Merriman, has revealed that the company closely watches pirate download figures in countries in order to determine which TV shows the company should buy. And so by seeing which shows are popular on piracy sites, they can get an idea of which shows will be successful on Netflix. And they said that that's why they bought the rights to Prison Break in the Netherlands, for example. And I just think this is really great. Netflix has got this approach completely right. Instead of trying to stamp out piracy websites, it's actually trying to create a product that's easier to use and provides a better user experience than torrenting otherwise would. And it reminds me a bit of the Brazilian author Paulo Coelho, who actually tells people to pirate his books, as it then drives the physical sales of his books and helps to inform where his publishers should next publish.
Yeah, we wrote about him, didn't we, a couple of years ago, I think. I think Cory Doctorow has got a similar view on this sort of stuff, putting things out for free and assuming that, you know, the word of mouth and everything will help encourage physical sales.
Yeah, and I think a lot of companies do talk about big data, but very few of them live and breathe it like Netflix does. And we've also previously written about the fact that it analyzes all the viewing figures within its own platform to help decide which original shows it can make, because it started commissioning original programming.
Right, they did that with House of Cards.
Yeah, they did that with House of Cards because they had a BBC kind of previous iteration of House of Cards on the platform, and that was very popular. And amongst the people who liked that program, they also liked Kevin Spacey as an actor and the David Fincher, who's the director of House of Cards.
So they thought, people are watching this program. They also like Kevin Spacey, and they also like other films directed by David Fincher. So they got David Fincher to direct a series that starred Kevin Spacey that was a remake of a popular program on the platform.
Yeah, and
I mean, that's brilliant, isn't it?
And they invested $100 million in it. So, you know, they're really committing to it. I think it's great.
This reminds me a little bit, actually, of how Lady Gaga manages her tour set lists, actually. Because what they do when they're going on tour to new regions, they actually look at the popularity of certain songs on streaming services like Spotify. So if they're going to, you know, play a show in somewhere in Scandinavia, say, they might look at Scandinavian Spotify counts or iTunes downloads and make the set list that they're going to do in concert based on which songs are most popular, and also do it the other way around. So songs that aren't popular in certain regions actually get kicked out of a set list. Well, that's going to wrap up the first news portion of the show. A couple of very exciting things coming up. Just after we finish our break in a moment, we're going to hear an interview I have done with Genevieve Bell from Intel Labs. We've talked about some amazing stuff, that a lot of which has come out of Intel's IDF conference over in the US. And then after that, we're going to have a quick look at what the Ig Nobel Prizes were awarded for this year. Look at the clock. Do you know what it says? Ignore it. It's audiobook time. Audible.co.uk is still offering you, our beloved listeners, a free book from its catalogue of 80,000 or more for being one of our dearest podcast listeners. Now, 1 month free trial, as you know very well by now, costs no pounds, no pence, and whatever book you choose to download for no money is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account, which you probably won't want to, or at least I haven't in the last 10 years. Head over to audible.co.uk/wired, sign up in a few single clicks of your mouse, download a book, enjoy it on us. You'll be supporting our show every week, which we appreciate. And what's not to like? Let's be honest. Do it now. audible.co.uk/wired. I'm joined now by Genevieve Bell, who is Director of Interaction and Experience Research at Intel Labs. Genevieve, welcome to the program.
Hi, Nate. Nice to be here.
Now, first question, what exactly is a director of interaction and experience?
I always love being asked that question. I run a small advanced research and development lab in Intel Labs at Intel, and my job, my brief as it were, is to reinvent the way we experience computing. Go.
Now, I read a number of reports that over the last few days that we're developing connections with technology in more and more ways like we develop relationships with people. Now, how true is this, and how far can this go?
Well, I like that there's a sense that that might be a complicated question to ask. So, I mean, it's very clear when you look at how people talk about the technology they have in their lives, we already have an emotional relationship with that technology, ranging from the ways we talk about television, fondness in people's voices when they talk about their television, sometimes guilty pleasure, but pleasure nonetheless. When you listen to the way people talk about their mobile devices, particularly phones, both the language we use to them, I love my phone, to the ways we carry them in our pockets, in our hands, to the fact that a vast majority of us sleep with them within arm's reach, and a fairly large percentage of us, although we would never admit to it, sleep with them under our pillows.
Guilty.
Me too. Suggests that there's a kind of a way those objects are very close to us. But for me, I think what's much more interesting is not about where we are today, but about where this sort of area is moving. And I actually think we're on the beginning of a significant paradigm shift from what in my field would be called human-computer interaction to what I think is sort of human-computer relationships. And for me, there's something there about moving from a command and control infrastructure, which, you know, comes out of things like air traffic control, to something that's a little more pervasive, proactive, a little more, in some ways, intuitive. Devices that are operating on our behalves, not necessarily with us having to drive it, suggests a very different kind of world, and one that I know is immediately suffused with dystopic science fiction. If the machine can care for us, surely the machine can kill us, is sort of where that logical thread tends to take us. But I actually think there are other ways of imagining that sort of notion of machines in our lives, of technologies in our lives that are caring for us and partnering with us rather than just us having to do all the work.
And this doesn't relate to the idea of actually feeling like you're in a relationship with your tablet computer, right?
I think people already are in relationships with their tablet computer, mostly frustrating ones. You know, whether it's about there isn't enough storage, why isn't it connecting to the thing, or the sense of mild panic when it's not near you. I think those are already, whether we want to think about them that way or not, they're already, in some ways at least, affective relationships. So there's, you know, emotional stakes in it. I think what's more complicated is that those are not necessarily relationships of reciprocity, so there's not a sense that the machines are worrying about us in quite the same ways we worry about them. And I think it's not necessarily about imagining that you'll be in love with your phone or that you'll want to, you know, have it as the only presence in your life. But, you know, there are lots of different kinds of relationships we have in the world with other people. Not all of them are, you know, relationships of love. Some of them are just relationships of mutual engagement or forms of reciprocity. And I think imagining sort of a spectrum of relationships rather than just interactions is, for me, a much richer space to operate in.
I guess in a sense, there is an element of technology worrying about us in return, in this sort of notion of the quantified self and of a machine constantly monitoring perhaps blood pressure or fitness or activity, and can actually remind you, hey, you haven't done X, Y, and Z today. You know, I suppose it's an artificial way of reciprocating that attention and concern.
Yeah, that's nice. I hadn't thought about that one. I mean, I'm often sort of struck by the fact that some of the more successful e-commerce ventures are the promise of a certain sort of at least attention. You know, every time you come back to Amazon, it says, hey, since you were gone, we found some things we think you'll like. Now, sure, that's about commerce, but it's also about, you know, it's paying attention to you. It is a promise of things delivered to you. So there's sort of something about, as we start to think through a world of devices that are constantly sensing, where there is interesting forms of analytics, I think the notion of objects that are smarter than the quantified self ones today that start to go, okay, not only have you not walked, but you think you want ice cream, and we could make you walk to get ice cream, so maybe there are some other ways of configuring your afternoon, may, from where we sit right now, feel manipulative and creepy, but I think has really interesting kind of an unfolding there of what we choose to opt into and what we don't.
Let's talk about wine. I read Intel demonstrated a processor powered by wine at IDF. Now, how does that work, and what is the benefit of not drinking wine and running a machine off it?
Okay, so that was me who did that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I should immediately feel guilty, I guess. We did that for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, in order to have this next, I think, era of computing, of, you know, Internet of Things, wearable computing, computation that requires very little power to have the same level of performance or more performance is hugely important. So, you know, how we start to think about getting to lower and lower forms of power, quark just being the first of what I think will be, you know, multiple generations of technology that do this, really what I wanted to demonstrate was that we were starting to talk about powering things off less than even batteries. So, you know, most battery cells, fairly low technology, right? Turns out wine, especially cheap red wine, not from Australia, I would just like to add, cheap red wine, it's highly acidic and it has enough acid in it to run a battery. And so raw power, in this case, a very low power microprocessor. And really what I wanted to do in that demo was display that we can start to imagine a world where it's not going to require very much to power things. I'm not suggesting that you should turn all the cheap plonk into your house into a battery, but it was a way of starting to say we can continue to drive innovation in this space and get to a point where we can power technology off less and less. Mm. Wasn't really just about turning wine into electricity.
So looking to the future, there are billions of people on this planet who may benefit from technology developed by Intel and its competitors, but how do you research and develop technology for such widely varying economic and social environments?
So many technology companies, including Intel, have teams of research social scientists who spend time in many different places all over the world getting a sense of what makes people tick, what they care about. At Intel, we have a couple of different teams of social scientists who spend time in people's homes, in the places they make meaning in their lives, all over the world to try and get a sense of what motivates people, what's important to them, what people want for their families, their communities, themselves, their kids, and use those larger kind of insights about what drives and motivates people to think about what the next generation of technology should be. It's also a way of identifying what the kind of critical pain points are in people's lives, because we don't always know how to articulate them, but when you're sitting with people, they become very obvious very quickly. And so I think for lots of companies, of which Intel is one, we have a really strong commitment to having a kind of rigorous methodology for making sense of the world, which actually means going there and spending time in places all over the world and trying to make sense of it.
Now, I'm not going to ask you to comment directly on developments by certain Cupertino-based companies, but a recent product announcement by one such firm recently saw it include movement processors inside a smartphone that aims to provide real-world monitoring, similar to what Nike does with its Fuel Band and the Fitbit and similar products. Now, do you think innovations similar to these and wearable tech in general are what consumers actually want long-term?
What an interesting question. So I think there's a couple of threads to unpack there, right? The first is that wearable technology is hardly a new thing. We've been wearing technologies on our body for as long as there has been technologies we could wear on our body. Think swords, armor, you know, glasses, watches. None of those things are new, right? We've augmented our bodies and ourselves for a really long time. And the fact that we want to continue to do so hardly surprises me. You know, our bodies are a place where we talk about who we are to ourselves and others, so that we want to decorate that with the things that are the moment of our time, hardly surprising. I think, but there are some key challenges to overcome there, right? One of them is how those devices know it's us. So I think, you know, we are moving to a world where getting all of us to have more and more secure passwords, i.e. quote-unquote harder passwords, is not scaling terribly well. You know, we'd done some stuff in the States and worked out that the average American consumer had something like 18 passwords, which is a tremendous number of them to remember, and most of us don't. And in fact, most people write down all those passwords on a piece of paper, which immediately makes you astonishingly insecure. Or better yet, my favorite one is they store them inside their computing devices in folders marked things like password, which sort of makes you vulnerable, right? So we know if we're going to talk about wearable technologies, we're going to have to solve some of the security issues. And I think some of the most interesting stuff that's happening in that space is about using your body as a form of authentication and then starting to think about multi-factor authentication. We demoed something on stage at IDF last week that was about using your gait, so the way you walk, as a way of identifying who you are. As long as the phone is also proximate to your voice, you can start to use that as a reasonable kind of proxy for identity. And I think, you know, fingerprint scanners are a whole other way of doing that. There's some stuff that's being tested in some of the labs, both at Intel and elsewhere, of using a way to read the veins in your palm as a form of authentication. So there's multiple versions of that that are happening. So I think, you know, what we're starting to see is a range of using your body as a, effectively as an identity token, as a security token. And that for me is really interesting as you play that out over time.
That was Genevieve Bell from Intel Labs. She doesn't have a blog, but I do highly recommend following her on Twitter. She is at Feral Data over there. She's got a fantastic, I think, sort of traced drawing of Australia or something as her profile pic right now. It's really quite worth the look. So do check her out over there. Okay, well, that took up a lot of our second half's allotted time. So we're going to do one segment for discussion this week, and that is Thank You, Science. This week, we are thanking science for the Ig Nobel Prize Awards ceremony. Now, this is something that takes place every year. I think I remember once the people who organized it described it as research that makes you laugh first and think second.
Exactly.
Or words to that effect.
It's perfect. That's
so we wanted to run down what prizes had been won this year. I mean, previous years, some of my favorites have included a bra that could also be used as a breathing mask, a gas mask, sort of situations where breathing masks suddenly became more essential than breast support. But fantastic innovation. So why don't we start with the medicine prize this year, Nick?
Yeah,
Nicholas.
So the medicine prize is for assessing the effect of listening to opera on mice heart transplant patients.
Fantastic.
I won't even want to begin to think how you would do that, but anyway.
The psychology prize, interesting one, to do with booze.
This is for confirming that people who think they are drunk also think that they are more attractive.
Now, I wonder what that is about, you know, because surely they must know they're drunk.
Well, this is certainly something that I suffer from. As soon as I'm drunk, I'm more attractive, I dance better, I'm hilarious,
yeah.
I'm interesting,
yeah,
all of that.
I know that feeling. I mean, I feel like that all the time, but it does get amplified when you're a bit drunk.
Yeah, I mean, definitely the dancing. I'm all over it.
There was a joint prize in biology and astronomy this year.
This is for discovering that when dung beetles get lost, they can navigate their way home by looking at the Milky Way.
I think that's actually genuinely awesome. Like, some of these things are like, this is ridiculous. I think that is incredible.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what you're going to do with that information.
Well, you could use it to use it as potential future guidance systems for automatons or Mars snakes. Well, the dung beetle is one thing, but, you know, if you learn it from the dung beetle, you could apply it to future things.
Yeah.
You know, what's so special about using the Milky Way? You know, if it's like a standard candle or a North Star or something.
Somehow hack its brain, like in the last episode.
Yep.
Yes.
Okay, safety engineering prize. This one was really fascinating, I think.
Okay, so this is for inventing an electromechanical system to trap airplane hijackers. The system drops a hijacker through trap doors, seals him into a package.
Or her.
Then drops the hijacker through the airplane's special installed bomb bay doors, through which he, or her, is parachuted to the ground, where police, having been alerted by radio, await his, or her, arrival.
It's such a high-tech solution, and then alerted by walkie-talkie to collect.
Gustano Pizzo from the US took that award home for a singular piece of research. That's fantastic. Now, the physics prize was particularly interesting if you've ever wanted to run across water, I think.
Yeah, so for discovering that some people would be physically capable of running across the surface of a pond if those people and that pond were on the moon.
Fantastic. Again, another one that sort of spans multiple countries, from the UK, US, I think, and actually it's all European, all these names. The chemistry prize was awarded for something to do with tears.
For discovering that the biochemical process by which onions make people cry is even more complicated than scientists previously realised.
Oh, God, what could you do with that? What could you do with that? Because it's discovering that it's more complicated. It's not really determining new ways to avoid it. I always suck a spoon.
And it's just a problem that is not something that we're going to invest money in trying to solve, are we?
I thought that by more complicated, they meant on a more profound level. There's some sort of... We're feeling some sympathy for these onions.
All right, the archaeology prize. I actually did a literal lol when I first read this one.
This is for observing how the bones of a swallowed dead shrew dissolve inside the human digestive system.
I hate to think to participate in that study.
It's like these weird rules you get on sites like eBay, where there's a specific rule for something ultra specific, that, you know, things like, I don't know, you can't sell gravestones or something.
Yeah.
Because someone tried to do it and they got into a lot of trouble. So they write in a very specific clause. And you have to wonder, you know, what happened here where someone did swallow a dead shrew and it caused an issue that caused someone to want to research into what happened afterwards.
It's very odd. It's very peculiar.
Okay, three more. Peace Prize.
For making it illegal to applaud in public, and to the Belarus State Police for arresting a one-armed man for applauding.
I'd applaud a one-armed man who is able to applaud.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's pretty awesome. Probability Prize. Two related discoveries here, I think.
This is a tick.
First, that the longer a cow has been lying down, the more likely that cow will soon stand up.
Doesn't that apply to everybody?
If I've been laying down for 12 hours, it's more likely I'm going to get up in the next hour than if I'd have been lying down for 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And second, that once a cow stands up, you cannot easily predict how soon that cow will lie down again.
Why do you want to know this?
Predicting the rain, the weather? I don't know.
Yeah. They are not effective weather gauges, as I've discovered.
All right. Well, we've saved the last one, which is the till last, for a reason. This is the Public Health Prize, and it involves penises.
This is for the medical techniques of penile reattachment after amputations, often by jealous wives. Techniques which they recommend, except in cases where the amputated penis had been partially eaten by a duck.
Awarded to colleagues exclusively in Thailand. Again, yeah. The subtext there, what happened in Thailand that made this so compelling to be researched?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious what happened in Thailand.
Yes.
What happened in Thailand stays in Thailand.
Yeah. They're ducks.
Yes. Okay, interesting. Well, they're the Ig Nobels. Now, we've got a write-up on the site on wired.co.uk, but it is really worth going over to the Ig Nobel Prize website and their related pages. If you do a Google or a Bing for Ig Nobel, IG Nobel, some fascinating background to all these stories that we just haven't got time to get into. It's taken us 5 or 6 minutes just to read them out. Strongly recommend having a look over there if you are interested in hearing more about these awards. Okay, well, we've gone over a bit today, so I'm afraid no time for feedback this week, but we will get to your questions and comments next week. Do keep them pouring in. podcast@wired.co.uk, on Facebook at facebook.com/wiredUK, and on Twitter at wiredUK. Liv, Nicholas, it's been a pleasure.
It has. Bye.
You've finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.
Liv, give me some sound.
Here is my sound.
That's a good sound, actually.
Really?
Nicholas, yep, give me some
Hello.
Sound.
Hello, do you want me to do my BBC voice?
I want you to do exactly what you did last week.
Okay.